Thanks for listening to this special podcast series on the Christian world of The Hobbit. I'm Serena Higgins from Iambic Admonit. This is the fourth of five shows exploring Devin Brown's book. Hopefully you've had a chance to hear the previous three programs on the Christian world of The Hobbit. If not, you can do so by visiting EssentialCSLewis.com to download or listen to them online. Speaking of EssentialCSLewis.com, William O'Flaherty, who created that site and is the producer of these episodes, is also standing by to share hosting duties. Welcome back, William.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
And Dr. Devin Brown, who wrote The Christian World of the Hobbit, is our special guest, and he is present and a vital part of the show today. Thank you for being here, Devin.
Thank you, Serena. Hey, William.
Well, Devin, why don't you take a moment to share with us, as you have done in an earlier program, about the three books that you wrote related to C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicle?
Oh, yeah. Well, as you mentioned, I did three books on Narnia so far, and we should say so far. Inside Narnia looks at The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Inside Prince Caspian, I just got to say, a somewhat anatomical title. You know, here's his spleen, here's the gallbladder. Inside Prince Caspian followed, and then Inside the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And as I try to explain to my mom and her friends, these are books about a book. And if that's your cup of tea, then like it is mine, you'll like it. Of course, you got to read the originals first. Anyway, that's where I first kind of got into the world of publishing books on Lewis and Tolkien. And when they pulled the plug on the Narnia films, temporarily, we all hope, I happened to notice there's a little film coming out this December called The Hobbit, and shifted over to write a little bit about Tolkien.
So do you think that you're going to write three books on The Hobbit, one for each episode of the film?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've written all I can think of right now on The Hobbit. What I would like to do is to write a book about Silver Chair, so let's all keep our fingers crossed that that comes out sooner rather than later.
Okay, great. Well, let's return to the main subject of today's episode, Tolkien's Hobbit and your book about it. So we're exploring the fourth chapter, which is called I Don't Think I Ought To, The Moral Landscape in The Hobbit. So the topic of your chapter, morality in The Hobbit, is clearly a very important theme throughout the book. But how do we know that the morality in Tolkien's story can be considered specifically or exclusively Christian?
Well, that's a great question. And I would just say this. I hit a turning point when I was reading The Everlasting Man by Chesterton. And Chesterton said this. He said, the best way to view Christianity is from inside it. And if that isn't possible, to view it from very far away. And the answer is then that once you pull the plug on Christianity, turn your back on it and say that this world is just a bunch of random atoms and molecules that's come together with no purpose, no meaning. I really think if you're going to be honest, and I'm going to say the existentialist writers pretty honest about this, brutally honest, then you're also going to pull the plug on any idea that there's any objective right or wrong. And so if we find objective right or wrong, as we do, this idea that it's not right or wrong isn't just what I think it is, but there's something beyond what I think, then we have to turn to Christianity if we're really going to be honest with ourselves. So that's a good question. Somebody might just say, well, that just seems like my morality. And I would say, well, guess what? Your morality lines up pretty right with what Christian morality is. So that's a complicated answer, but you get the idea.
Something we didn't talk about in episode 3, but you do mention in your book, but you go into more detail here in chapter 4, is that Bilbo's decision to not kill Gollum when he could have, this is not an easy choice. You even say that it mirrors, quote, the complex moral choices often found in the real world. I wonder if you could discuss that in context and another complex decision you mentioned related to Thorin and Bard later.
Yeah, I mean, who think The Hobbit is just some simplistic children's story. And I got an interview from a kind of a Tolkien person who kind of said, I don't get how you can write about this. Well, I would really hope that you read Tolkien carefully and look at that layered nuance. Here's Bilbo trying to get out of the Misty Mountains. There's Gollum before him. And man, he could stab him and get out of there and be safe. And he goes through a lovely line of reasoning. And I want to suggest that most of the people listening to us right now have done that exact same thing. Well, should I do this or not? And he says, well, gosh, I'm armed. He isn't. So that doesn't seem quite right. He never said he was actually going to kill me. And then the third one, which I really love, and there's others, by the way, is he actually is based. He's a poor, miserable creature living underneath these mountains. And man, I should feel sympathy for him, not antagonism, even though he's after me right now. So, yeah, this kind of layered, complex choice is really more like the modern world than some sort of simplistic, one-dimensional children's story.
And then you also mentioned another complex decision he has to make in relation to Thorin and Bard. You want to talk about that one as well?
You mean the Arkenstone one?
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, these are central points. That's the other thing I should say, is that these aren't some sort of side episodes. These are pivotal points in the story. And by making them that hinge around which the whole story swings, Tolkien is really saying something about the moral universe there, the moral landscape of The Hobbit. So, yeah, should he slip away, give Bard the Arkenstone, come back? It wasn't really his to give, but there's this higher calling. I want to stop this battle that's about to ensue and all this bloodshed that should happen. And yet, after he does all that, he comes back because he feels what I would say a rather complex loyalty to the dwarves and all they've been through. So, even then, this idea of learning what's right and wrong, right? He has to, like people today, he's got to think about things, and he sees the negative example of Thorin there and comes to realize where all this is headed gradually, not overnight, and finally decides he has to take a stand at that point.
Several times throughout this chapter, you point out that Tolkien appears to believe that there is only one right moral option to any choice or decision. Now, can't there be more than one morally right option in a situation?
Yeah, let me see if I can't phrase that a little bit better. In other words, Tolkien suggests that there's a best choice, and we're meant to choose from better to best. Like, this idea would be good, now this other choice would be better, but this last one would be best. And well, that captures the nuance that we all face in our lives in this world, right? Why is this one better than that? Well, because it would address these issues. And why would this be the best choice? And Bilbo has this, and we see this all the way through The Lord of the Rings, where Aragorn, who's like a really smart guy, has to sit down and go, gosh, what should I do here? It's really quite complicated, and thinks and finally comes up with the best answer. And yeah, that's what I think Tolkien wants to suggest. In his life, in our lives, and in the lives of his characters, there's a best moral choice, and it will take some digging to find it.
Now, one of the things that you point out here is that when dealing with moral and morality and such, there's a false criticism that went about even during the lifetime of C.S. Lewis, and he actually commented about that. Could you tell us what that is and what he commented about?
Yeah, and it's funny because people who like Lewis and Tolkien don't even think about it because it seems so clear. But there was this criticism from the outside that his characters were one-dimensional. And I guess an example for us, we think of the John Wayne movies where the good guys wore white hats and the bad guys wore black hats. Or let's just be honest, the good guys were the cowboys and the bad guys were the Indians. And for the most part, we don't find that among the major characters in Middle Earth, right? Each of them has the potential to do good or to do bad, Bilbo himself. And of course, that's the reason why we have these mirrored characters. Bilbo's right choices that he ends up making, not without difficulty, are mirrored in Gollum. Here's Gollum, a hobbit who's made bad choices. But within Gollum, right, we have Smeagol and Gollum, who could be the good side and the bad side. This idea of free will was central to Tolkien's faith, that we've been given free will, the ability to choose right or to choose wrong. And each of us has that ability and, you know, never loses that ability. Boromir, of course, will be another example. And, of course, later in The Lord of the Rings, we'll have paired characters that show that exact thing. So Denethor will be the bad choices, and he'll have his counterpart. Faramir and Boromir have their counterparts. And we say that again and again. And I see that as Tolkien's way of emphasizing. And each of us may have two sides. I don't know what we call them, but the idea to choose right and to choose wrong.
So I was going to ask you next about Tolkien's approach to the problem of evil, and you're already touching on that by saying one of the ways that Tolkien sort of solves the problem of evil is by focusing on free will. And you talk a lot in your chapter about how Tolkien's characters are realistic mixtures of good and evil. What do you think Tolkien believes about the nature of good and evil, about their own existence? They have independent absolute existences, or what are the nature of good and evil for Tolkien?
Well, you're getting awfully philosophical for an English professor. But I'll do what other people have kind of taught me, and that is to say both Lewis and Tolkien don't believe that evil exists as sort of there's a good God and a bad God, that God created things good and that evil is taking free will and turning it bad. There's a famous line before Screwtape where Lewis was asked if I believe in devils, and he said, I believe in devils, but not as the opposite of God. He said Satan is more like the opposite of Saint Michael or one of the archangels, right? That evil exists as good turned bad. And I got to tell you, people sort of miss the start at the bookends of The Hobbit, where Bilbo starts out with good turned bad in his hobbit hole, where he's a slave to his tea kettle and his waistcoats and his pipe and his handkerchief. And at the end, it's good renewed to be where it's supposed to be. He enjoys all those things, but with an inordinate love. So it doesn't take much to twist a good thing to be bad. Even a good thing can be twisted into something that it's not meant to be.
Right. I think that's exactly right, that each of Tolkien's evil characters are a twist on a good character. So the orcs are twisted elves, and the goblins are twisted men, and Gollum is a twisted hobbit. I think that's right.
Yeah, and, you know, Saruman is a twisted Gandalf, right?
Yes.
Another part of this chapter you devote to exploring Tolkien's, quote, antidote to greed, and you use the expression sacramental ordinary. What does this mean, and how do we see it in the Hobbit?
And I'm going to jump off of that and add to the question about the sacramental ordinary. Can you also, in your answer, give us an official definition of sacrament and talk about whether Tolkien's is a particularly Roman Catholic view of sacrament or whether it's sort of a mere Christian universal idea of sacramentalism?
And I think we have 2 minutes left. Great. I'll give it to you in a nutshell. How is Bilbo able to avoid the greed, this power that gold seems to have over everybody, right? Men, elves, dwarves, goblins, wargs, a dragon, right? Well, he temporarily succumbs to it, but in the end, he's able to not succumb to it. And Tolkien suggests that he's found a different kind of wealth. And the term I call it in my book is the sacramental ordinary. The ordinary things around us are not just material things made up of atoms and molecules. There's something there. And Tolkien suggests very faintly nuanced that these are created things that bear the mark of their creator, right? And I don't know, is it fair technically to go back to Silmarillion and kind of talk about more explicitly that? I don't know. But at the end of the day, these things have value in a sort of a holy, sacramental way. And of course, as you mentioned, this is a Roman Catholic tenet that's emphasized in that faith. But I'm pretty convinced it's there in all Christian faith, this idea that just like a potter leaves a stamp of his own self on every pot he makes, creator is present in each element of creation. And so a flower is just not just a flower or a leaf or a tree or a breeze. They all bear something that points beyond.
And of course, we encourage people to get a copy of your book, The Christian World of the Hobbit, where you go into more detail about this, as well as other aspects as we've been looking about the moral landscape in The Hobbit.
And unfortunately, that's just about all the time that we have together today, so we'll wrap up here. I'm Sorina Higgins, and I'm the book review editor of Zamezook's The C.S. Lewis Journal, which you can find by Googling The C.S. Lewis Journal or going to the Arizona C.S. Lewis Society. And you can see more of my work at my site, Iambic Admonite. That's IAMBICADMONIT. And thanks very much to William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com for providing all the behind-the-scenes work to make all this happen. Thank you, William.
You're quite welcome.
And I understand that you have some new plans ahead for 2013. Can you give us some details?
Yes, for those who are listening to this as we are releasing them before the start of 2013, I'll be doing a week-by-week look at Lewis's life and things that happened and share about either his works and how it relates. So that'll be coming out weekly when you go to EssentialCSLewis.com. It's a little pet project I've been working on and really excited about it, to where, you know, what happened during the course of Lewis's life any particular year that week. So the first week of January, we'll see what happened throughout his life and talk about his various works in his life. So I'm excited about that.
That sounds wonderful. It sounds very relevant and a good time to do it. And Dr. Devin Brown, I think that ties in a little bit to your new project you have in hand, yeah?
I've been working on a spiritual biography of Lewis. It's titled A Life Observed. Lewis fans know that he wrote a book called A Grief Observed, where I look at his spiritual journey and not just ending with his conversion, but going all the way to his death. And that will come out in 2013 as well.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. And thank you very much for being here, Devin. And let's end by having you give us a quick preview of what to expect in the fifth and final episode.
Well, chapter 5 in my book is called Response and Legacy. And the idea of how people responded to The Hobbit and Tolkien fiction and what he's left for us, I think, is a great one.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.